Okay, we're studying today from the 13th chapter of the Testimony of St. John. We're getting into the really heart of the story, or the climax, really, more than the heart of it. And it starts off saying, when the Jewish feast of the Passover arrived, and it specifies this because, while there is a feast of the Passover on the Gnostic calendar, the two calendars kind of diverge a bit, because they're both lunar calendars, and they make up for the difference of the solar calendar by adding what are called intercalary days. But the Gnostics add them every year, and the Jewish calendar only adds them every so often, so gradually there's a divergence. And the only reason that's significant at all is because we commemorate the Last Supper at one time, and the Passover at a different time in the Jewish and the Gnostic calendar, because the date of the Last Supper was according to the Jewish calendar, and that moves it over, which isn't of great importance, except it gives us an opportunity to do it twice. Anyway, the main thing to be aware of is that there is a Gnostic calendar and that is different, and that it focuses us in a harmony with the passing of the seasons, just as any calendar might, but it does it according to a drama that's played out. So every year we play out this drama of the descent, life, and death, and ascension of the Redeemer. And that's to keep that alive in our own consciousness as we're going to see as we go along. Jesus knew that the time had come when he would leave the mortal plane to ascend to the Father and Mother. Now that's how he would have looked at it. Not, it hadn't come time for him to die. It had come time for him to leave the mortal plane to ascend. Because that's what he's teaching us to do. Now death is a little factor in that. And he teaches us that it's the death of egocentricity, so that we can ascend to a divine state where our divine nature is coming out. But the important thing is we're leaving the mortal plane so that our lives, our perceptions aren't centered on in this mortal plane to ascend to the divine plane. So that even though we're here amongst mortals, we're living in a divine consciousness. And that alters the decisions we make, it alters what we do. But it brings us better results. It means we're dealing with realities instead of with illusions. And that means that when we do something, the result happens instead of something different happening and we don't know why. The love he had shared with his disciples throughout his mortal ministry would carry him through to the end when he would offer his life for them. Now life is a big theme here through this end of John. A love is. And what he's trying to tell us ultimately is that it's all about love. John himself in an epistle later says that God is love. That is, love is what is divine. And here he's saying of the Redeemer that this whole thing he's enacting is a manifestation of love. It's to teach us love. It's so that we can understand love, so that we can become synonymous with love, so that love becomes our reality. And that's the key he's putting right here in the beginning of it. Now, in fact, for some strange reason, whoever originally translated this into English separated chapters 13 and 14 right in the middle of a paragraph on this matter of love. And there's a whole chapter that really just centers on how all of this relates to love. And that we're going to leave for next week. But he's introducing the theme right here. Judas of Kerioth, son of Simon, had entered a covenant with the gods of darkness to betray the son of the Elohim. Now Judas is an archetypal figure, just as Christ is an archetypal figure. They represent different things that exist within mortal nature. The divine potential on the one hand, and the drawing toward the divine opposite on the other hand. And how these interrelate. But probably the key thing here is that both of them are essential to the working out of this divine drama of love. There's no suggestion that Judas wasn't as essential to the process as Christ. And in fact, Jesus at the Last Supper said, I knew who I was choosing when I picked you. And one of you will betray me. Meaning, that's an essential part of the whole process, this working of the opposites within us. And so Judas' role was as much a significant role, a valid role, as Christ's role. And in fact, we see Judas as like the the Christ on the other side. That is the emanation of the other half of our personality that Christ doesn't manifest. Because in order to perfectly manifest what Christ has come to show us, there has to be something left out. That's the shadow that's repressed. And Judas represents that repressed part. And they actually have to work together to make the whole thing happen. We have to acknowledge Judas' role as valid, just as we have to acknowledge the shadow is valid. Just as we have to acknowledge that darkness is valid, that everything has a valid place in the working of the whole. If it didn't, it wouldn't exist. It's not true, as the Orthodox myth would kind of indicate, though I don't think they would ever say it, because they don't know what to do with their own myth. It's not true that evil somehow results from a rebellion against God. Such a thing is unthinkable if you think of God as that which is, as reality, as, or even as the omnipotent God, as the Orthodox might say. There can't be a rebellion. Whatever exists has to be a part of the whole that is divine, the whole reality. And so in Judas and Christ, we have two archetypal manifestations of different aspects of the divine brought down to the mortal plane and working with each other, I could say, or against each other, I could say, but working in juxtaposition to each other, bringing about what needs to happen for redemption, for lifting us up. It's the whole working in us that leads us to the development of our divine potential. It's the working of the shadow as well as of the ego, as well as of the divine light within. That's what we're being shown through these archetypal characters. Jesus knew that the Father and Mother had given him power over everything, for by this time his true nature had been revealed to him. And that's telling us about ourselves. When we really perceive our true nature, we realize we have power over our lives, we have power over what around us, we have power over what happens. Doesn't mean we're in control of everything, it means we have power so that whatever happens, we can turn it to good. That's what Jesus showed in crucifixion. Crucifixion is negative no matter how you look at it. It's deplorable. It's horrendous. It's not just dying. And it's the Christian means to deification. The key is that we are to take whatever happens, however horrendous, and we turn it to be something powerful and good. That gives us control over our lives. We can't keep negative things from happening, but we can keep them from remaining negative. Keep them from having negative impact. That's our power. Above all, that's our power. He knew that he had come from the Elohim and that he was returning to the Elohim. Again, that's being said for us. When we know where we come from, that is, that we come from the divine, and where we're headed, that is, we're headed to the divine, then we know who we are, why we are, and what's going on with us. And Jesus knew those things, so that gave him power in his life, because he understood his true nature and what he was about. When we understand our true nature and what we're about, which is the same, then we have power to accomplish, to ascend, just as Jesus has said. Well, all John says about the Last Supper itself is, after supper. He doesn't even mention it, other than that. He just mentions that it happened. You know, if you've read the testimony of St. Luke, or Matthew, Mark, they talk about it in detail. John knows they've talked about it in detail. John is undoubtedly the last of those four books that was written. He knows the story's out there, that it's known, that even the Orthodox know the story and all its details, even if they don't know sometimes what it means, and he doesn't bother repeating it. He's not suggesting it's not important, he's just suggesting that there's more that's important that isn't in the story the way everybody else hears it. So he starts by covering the whole story of the Last Supper with two words, after supper, and then wants to tell you what goes on from there, because as far as he's concerned, the Last Supper is a jumping off point. It's not the crux of the whole thing. It's the step to some metaphysical understanding that he wants to bring us to. So also, you need to remember that the principles covered by the Last Supper, John already covered way back when he had Jesus talking about living bread and living water and what this does in terms of us and our existence, which is what the myth of the Last Supper is trying to convey. So John's already figured it, covered it. And now he figures he could go on to something else that the Orthodox accounts don't even mention because they don't understand it. And that is, he goes on to the washing of feet. That's something that's not mentioned in any of the other accounts because that has no comprehension in Orthodox thinking. But John's going to bring it into our thinking. In the dialogue that follows between Peter and Jesus, I haven't left the washing feet, this is during the washing feet, leading up to the washing feet, we have the ego reasoning with the emanation of the hyperconscious, which has come into consciousness. So we have the ego debating with that divine that's coming out, trying to rationally figure out what's going on. Now that's something every one of us has to go through if the divine starts to come out in us. So this little story has got to be significant to us since we're on the path of Gnosis, because we're going to have this encounter if we haven't had it. The thing that's happening is that the ego keeps reasoning while Christ wants them to experience. That's the thing that we keep running into. Gnosis is about experience. We experience things. Then we understand them. Our conscious minds want to talk about the things. They want to reason about them. They want to figure it out. But it never happens until you experience it. I mean, you can figure out a lot of things. I'm not against reason. In fact, I'm a logical person by nature. I tend to reason. But it can't bring you to any ultimate insights. It can help you along the way through in different things, but until you actually experience what's real, you cannot know what's real, no matter how much you think about it, no matter how much you talk about it, no matter how much you listen about it. And that's exactly what's happening here between Jesus and Peter. So, we pass through the Orthodox part of the Last Supper, which has totally valid because it leads us to the Gnostic part, which is the confrontation between ego and the inner Christ. Well, Christ starts out trying to reason with him to lead him to the place where he can experience. But the ego keeps jumping to the wrong conclusions, right? Jesus will say something to Peter. Peter makes the wrong conclusion from it. Jesus shows him why he should let him wash his feet. He says, well, wash my whole body then. That's not the point. He's still trying to reason. And the reasoning leads him to the wrong conclusion. In fact, our author says that the major reason that he's telling us about all this is to show that true sanctification requires more than following the customs of your ancestors. That it isn't, we can't just do what's been laid down for us, and we can't just try to reason it all out. We've got to be open to going down some paths we haven't gone down and experiencing the reality for ourselves. Now that means that no Gnostic teacher can logically help you see the reality either. Logically, we can help you get through some of the gates along the way, but ultimately you have to experience it for yourself, no matter what path you're trying to follow. So, while reason that's based on your experiences in your formative years, the things that you experienced with parents, with teachers, it can be helpful, but often it's going to lead you in the wrong direction. You can't limit yourself to that. There's nothing wrong with trying it out, but it won't be adequate in and of itself. You need to test everything against the light that's in you to discern its value. Well, then, after this goes on, and we've got the point of Jesus and Peter's dialogue, Jesus asked the question, do you understand what I have just done for you? This is after the washing of feet. Do you understand what I have just done for you? You call me your master and Lord. Now, Lord's just another word for master, as in master of Gnosis, Lord of Gnosis. When they called Jesus Lord, they just meant master. That's why we sometimes in our scriptures, Jesus will refer to as Lord. That's another way of saying Master, but it's not a term applied to the divine as a whole, though I guess you could say the whole divine is our Master, but it's something that's brought down the way we relate to it in our Western gnosis. So he said, you call me your Master and Lord. And it's true that I am. So these were his disciples. There was no question about that. If I, your Lord and Master, have washed your feet, then you certainly ought to wash one another's feet. I have given you an example to follow. A slave is not greater than his Lord, nor is a representative greater than what he represents. If you understand this principle, minister to one another as I have ministered to you. So he's not really talking about washing feet here. He picked that because that's something that the lowest person in the household would do for travelers when they came in. This is a time when everybody walked, you got dusty, they wore sandals. And when you get 10 days home, somebody would wash your feet, but it would always be the lowest slave. If there was one, or if there wasn't one, it would be some humble member of the household. It wouldn't be the head of the house. But he's saying, I'm trying to show you that you need to minister to the needs that people have. You can't be too good to minister to their needs. If I can wash your feet, you can do whatever's needed to help a person. This is the point that he's making to them. The feet are always right down in the dirt, so they pick up the most defilement. They represent metaphysical defilement. There are different times Jesus talks about that. Stamp the dust off your feet for this reason or that reason. Wash your feet for this reason or that reason. They represent metaphysical defilement. So, washing the feet is getting rid of all the metaphysical buildup that people have. So it's really helping people get past what's weighing them down from this mortal condition so that they can be free to ascend. The Jains talk about this as karma matter. They say all the things, every negative thing you do builds up another layer of karma matter on you, and it just weighs you down and weighs you down. Well, it's a good image. And if so, then as Gnostics, what we try to help people do is to shed these layers of karma matter, so to speak. Shed the things that weigh them down. Shed the defilement that is the effects of the negative choices they made so that they can rise up, so that they can ascend. We do this, which is the theme that is kind of building up to here, because we learn real love. It's love that allows us to help people free themselves. And anything else won't. Logic won't. That is, if I try to help a person because I like to play with ideas, there's nothing wrong with liking to play with ideas, but that won't help the person get free from the things that holds him or her down. But love will motivate me to do the right things and will allow the person to feel the necessary things to make a difference and to make freedom become a possibility in their lives. So all of this is really about love. Then Jesus reiterates that one of his disciples was chosen because he will take the role of darkness in the drama that's unfolded. He'll provide the opposite, so that through the working of the opposites, something positive can be generated. He wants to remind us that this is really an archetypal drama that's going on when he says that. When he says that one of his disciples has made a covenant with the gods of darkness, he's speaking in archetypal terms. This isn't something that goes on in our physical lives. This is something that goes on within. That is, there is that of us that has to make peace with the darkness so that we can work it through to where the darkness is in its proper place and we are free to be divine. Because the divine is not just light. The divine is light and darkness. It's all divine. And we have to get it all in a proper relationship in us to be divine. Throw half of it out. If you try to destroy it, there is no possibility for divinity because half of what is divine is gone. But if the relationship is appropriate and works right, then we become divine. So of course, the place where Christ and Judas matter is in their archetypal roles in us, in working out the light and the darkness and helping us to come to the point where we're whole. Then Jesus says, a person who accepts my representatives whom I send out is accepting me. And whoever accepts me is accepting those who sent me. Now, when I read that, I think, why is he saying that right then? It's like things are flowing along, and then he just throws in this sentence that didn't seem to exactly relate. Except that he isn't going to personally be there to help each person, to help us who are reading this account go through the transition to resurrection. So he's saying, what I am doing here in this account with my disciples, the same process will work for anybody who's mastered gnosis working with anyone who wants to. So it really is a key phrase that makes perfect sense, but it makes me, made me at least, every time it makes me, stop and think. You know, because it seems out of context. But it's really the key to the whole thing, is saying what's being told here isn't a historical account. It's an account of what can happen in you. It's an account that's always valid. It's a now account. Of course, in order for scripture to have any validity, it has to be a now story. Something that relates to what can happen with us now. It could be interesting to know what happened 2,000 or 4,000 or whatever years ago, but it doesn't have any real importance unless it can impact our lives now. That's what Jesus is saying here. Essentially, his representatives will know how to be midwives in the new birth, just like Jesus was. And on the other hand, he's saying to his disciples, you have to have the faith and courage to be midwives, to help others come through this new birth into a Gnostic life, into a centered life. The Gnostic Book of Covenants quotes Christ as saying, anyone who accepts my ministers accepts me, and anyone who accepts me accepts my parents. Anyone who accepts my parents will accept my parents' realm. In that case, everything my parents possess will be given to that person. I think that illuminates what he was saying. He's saying, the way to become divine is to work with those who have let the principles of Gnosis work in them, and it brings each person to the point where they become divine, where they become synonymous with the parents. Where everything the parents are, they become. We call this divine investing. That is, if you work with someone who is there to act in the place of, say, Christ, then that person is as though it were Christ working with you. That is, that person can help you through the transition, just as though the Christ himself did, because the Christ Spirit is in that person, and the Christ Spirit is doing the works through that person. It's not the person doing it. Christ can act through anything or anyone to accomplish a help to us. Then Judas is singled out in a manner recognizable to those who are following the conversation as being the one who is going to play the archetypal role of the opposition. And as soon as Jesus made this plain, it says, Judas went out into the darkness. I don't think that means he went out after dark. It means that he took his place to help the whole thing go forward. That he took his place on the dark side so that they could work out the drama of becoming free of the limitations of mortality. The drama of becoming divine. Not for them, but for us. Okay, now that darkness has commenced its role in the drama, Jesus begins to talk about light. Because he's the archetype of light. And he tells us right away that he is discussing archetypal matters because he refers to the Son of Man, who is an archetypal figure. Jesus sometimes calls himself the Son of Man, but whenever he does, he's talking of himself in an archetypal role. It's a title that represents a specific archetype of transition to divine humanity. Gnostics have always said that the divine is divine anthropos. Now, anthropos is a Greek term which means, it's usually translated man, but it has nothing to do with masculinity. So, human, perhaps. It means what we are. That the divine is just that brought to its divinity, to its full potential. And the Son of Man, therefore, is meant to be that. Son of anthropos means the projection of that onto the mortal plane so that we can relate to it. And so that it can be a means of helping us ascend to that divine place. So Jesus says, the time has arrived for the Son of Man to be perfected in light. so that the light of the Elohim can be increased through him. That is, that archetype leads us to individuation, that increases divine light, and then we can be a part of the process, be a part of the Son of Man, in leading others to individuation and so forth. So there's a whole process of increasing deification. Now again, he said, this is time for the Son of Man to be perfected in light. Now perfection is that state that leads to sanctification. When we speak of perfection, we don't mean being flawless. That just doesn't happen to us. As long as we're mortal, anyway. No matter what state, even though we're deified, we can have a bad day. It's allowed. We can say the wrong thing. It's allowed. We can even do something we shouldn't have done. It's allowed. But that doesn't change the issue of perfection. Perfection means developing our divine potential to the point where it's the center of our psyches. It takes the lead in our decision-making process. That's called perfection, because we're perfecting our psychological makeup by getting it into the state it should be in. So perfection for us doesn't mean flawless. It means individuation and sanctification. It means getting us psychologically whole to where we can do the right thing more often than not. Well, theoretically, we always can, but we just don't. But we do the right thing more often than not. But the perfect part is the psychological state we come into. If the light of the Elohim is increased through him, Jesus says, that is through the Son of Man, the parents will immediately increase the light in him and reveal his place among themselves. So if the Son of Man archetype works in us, the divine light increases in us, then the parents will show us that what's happening here is that we are finding our place with them, among them. That we are becoming synonymous with this divine archetype. So the next step beyond this perfection is deification, sanctification. We come into that place. Then Jesus says, "My little children, I will not be with you much longer. You will look for me, but I tell you, as I told the people generally, that you cannot come where I am going, even if you were to travel throughout the physical plane." Because Jesus is ascending above physical existence. Well, Peter wants to follow him. He's still approaching this rationally. Peter is the foil in this whole story of the ego approach. But Jesus says, "You're not ready to now, but you will follow me later when you are ready." We could take that as being just said through the ego in general. The ego can't just suddenly become divine, but it can get ready to become divine. We don't destroy the ego. We bring it into a place that is in harmony with the divine. That's what the potential is. Peter exclaims, "I'm willing to die for your sake." This is one of those times when Peter doesn't consciously know what he's saying, but unconsciously he knows. He knows consciously that the ego has to die and be resurrected to find its place. That is, it has to be died to its egocentricity and be resurrected as a part of the divine wholeness that is flowing in us. And so that's exactly what Peter's saying, even though he doesn't really realize what he's saying. "Do you really think you're willing to die for my sake?" Jesus asked him. "Believe it or not, before the rooster crows again, you will have denied me. You will have denied three times that you even know me in order to protect yourself." The point being, the ego doesn't give up that easily. Even when we're willing, perhaps desiring transformation, is still a process. We still hold on to that egocentricity. It's a part of our nature. There's no way around it. But if we're willing to give it the time, we can make a change. But when we think we're ready, when we think we're ready for the change, we usually are still far from it because we haven't yet even realized what a great change it is. Or we know we don't be ready that fast. It takes a lot of work, but it is something we can do. And we do have the assurance that when we are ready, we will ascend. That's what he said to Peter. "The time will come when you will be able to go around where I'm going. Will be resurrected." That's what that means. To be raised up to a theocentric life. That is to where our nature, our divine nature, has come through. I want to repeat my instructions, Jesus says, that you must love each other. You must love each other the way I have loved you. This is the key to going where I am going. It will be evident that you are my disciples only when you follow my example in the way you love each other. And they might know that paragraph when our chapter ends. But I read the words because that's where we're going to start with chapter 14, is how all of this really is about love, and how love is the key to the whole transformation. And when we learn to love, and we learn to love others the way we love ourselves, that is, the way the ego loves itself, that's also a key to learning how to love ourselves, not the ego loving itself, but our whole selves, all those parts, the parts that we've repressed, and the parts that we've never even known, that are hidden in the unconscious now. Through learning to love outwardly, we also learn to love inwardly. And love is the power that brings things together. We sometimes speak of a sealing power, that is, a cementing power, psychologically, metaphysically. It's love that is that power. It allows us to become whole and individuated, and it allows us as individual people to come together and become a greater wholeness, which is the true divine anthropos, the divine. So we'll leave it for next time. But it's a good way to end, because really everything begins with love and everything ends with love. And all the things we talk about, they all come around to love. Whether we say it or don't say it, it's the key that makes it all happen. And therefore, when John says, that which is divine is love, that's exactly the point. Everything else somehow comes out of that fact and somehow leads to it.